When we were first dating, Karen was a teaching fellow uptown in Manhattan, not far from where one of our congregants live, congregants' children live. We took a train down from Washington Heights, downtown, and a younger, large young man started berating someone in their 50s. What are you looking at? Classic stuff from the 80s cop shows. And then a fight broke out on the train, which we were later told may have been a piece of a gang initiation. It was among the scariest things I've ever seen, because the whole train exploded in this paroxysm of violence, and you could watch the other passersby and passengers fleeing to the ends of the train. And a few people on each side, myself included, started to approach, seeing if we could pull them apart. But what did it was something very different. A woman started yelling at them from her seat, "You're scaring my kid!" That was either before or after the train stopped at the next stop, I don't quite recall, and the younger man who had started the fight, who had picked the fight, left quickly, and Karen and I and maybe some other people escorted the older man, 50-something, built like a pipe fitter, to a police call box and medical attention. And I found a story, very similar story, that kind of a famous story that relays a similar situation. So this is in the book, The Power of a Positive No by William Ury. Anyone do Aikido? It's a martial art that's designed to do as little damage to your opponent, to contain your opponent, and do as little damage to him or her as possible. Which is, I think, this irony contained in your story, you'll see. So there's a young American living in Japan to study Aikido, and he was sitting one afternoon on a train in the suburbs of Tokyo, much like the story I told you. The carriage was half empty. There were mothers with children, a few elderly people shopping. Then at one station, the doors opened and a man staggered into the carriage, half drunk, shouting, dirty, aggressive. He started cursing at people and even lunged at a woman holding a baby. The blow hit her and the baby was knocked into the lap of an elderly couple next to her. They jumped up and ran to the other end of the carriage. I mean, it's the same experience of violence in a closed space that is inevitably terrifying. This angered the drunk, who went after them, and he was grabbing a metal pole, trying to wrench it out of his socket. It sounds like he was being destructive. It was a very dangerous situation in a small space. So this young student, the narrator of the story, again in Japan to study martial arts, readied himself for a fight. However, before he could mount his stance, there was a small elderly man in his 70s, dressed in a kimono, who shouted at the drunk, "Hey!" But in a friendly manner. "Come here and talk to me." And the drunk drifted over like he was in a trance. "Why should I talk to you?" he said. And the old man says, "What have you been drinking?" And the young man says, "Sake. It's none of your business." And the old man, with a nostalgic and reminiscent air, said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I love sake too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it out to the garden and sit on our old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down. We look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My great-grandfather planted that tree." And as he continued talking, the drunk's face started to soften and his fists slowly unclenched. "Yes, I love persimmons too," I'm sure, the old man said, that you also have a wonderful wife. No, the drunk says, no, my wife died. And he began to sob. I don't got no wife. I don't have a home. I got no job. I'm so ashamed. Tears rolled down his cheeks. The train rolled to the student's stop, and he was leaving the train, and he heard the old man sighing sympathetically. My, that's a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it. In the last glimpse that the student saw of them, the drunk was sitting with his head in the old man's lap, and the old man was stroking his hair. And what the student thought he would achieve with muscle, the old man achieved with kind words. Aside from, I think, being a very pretty story, there's a moral there for us in this day and age. In this day and age of concussive force against those with whom we disagree, in conversations that seem to break into rage. I was talking with Mel Sturm a couple of months ago. I lost the article, unfortunately, but he showed me an article that described our modern predicament as a cold civil war. It's a very ugly situation to be in, a cold civil war. Any kind of civil war is nightmarish. Maybe cold is better than outright violence, but explosive nonetheless, and not something you want to live in. When was the last time you talked to someone you fundamentally disagreed with? How much interaction do you have with people who aren't in your zip code or economic status or political party? People who don't look like you. People with different educational attainments. We're balkanized. And rather than listening and commiserating as that old man did around a persimmon tree and sake and beloved and sometimes departed family, we just brace ourselves for fights. The Midrash, the rabbinic compendia of legend, lore, as Anna would say, fan fiction, says that hate defeats rationality. We're at the brink of an irrational body politic, and the extremes pull farther and farther apart. If you've ever seen the bell curves of voting patterns in the Senate or even among the populace, there's less and less overlap and fewer districts where people split the ticket. And we've all, so many of us, become so righteous and so sure and assured of our positions, we're tearing the Republic apart. This great human experiment in constitutional democracy is withering. Also in Midrash, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, he's talking in a different context, but it is comparable to us. It's like people traveling in a boat, and one of them takes a drill and starts to drill underneath herself. Everyone else in the boat says, "What the heck are you doing?" And she says, "What do you care? I'm just drilling under myself. It's my seat." And of course, the companions reply, as is obvious, "You're going to sink us all." I'm not talking about impeachment. I'm not talking about one party or another. I just want that to be clear. If that's what you hear, I have misspoken. I'm talking about the boat we're all in. The ship of the United States of America that is threatening to rend itself apart with or without bad seas. And I think that our tradition, the Jewish tradition in general, and frankly, the conservative Jewish tradition, has something immeasurably valuable, priceless, to teach us about this. About 200 years ago, there was a Victorian essayist, Walter Bagehot, spelled B-A-G-E-H-O-T, if you read the name but not pronounced it. Walter Bagehot promoted the virtue of animated moderation. My mentor used to say that we don't have enough passionate moderates in the world. It's very easy to be passionate about Israel, right or wrong, or passionate about Palestine United. Not enough of us are passionate about pragmatism, good governance, cities that run well like ours. What used to be the province and domain of the Whig Party, the passionate moderates. We need more animated moderates, not just in Britain, but here. And I think it requires this mental wiring and this thought process that's become very foreign to us. And frankly, there's a bit of human evolution in that. Tribalism serves you well in a hunter-gatherer society. You watch out for the people who look like you and smell like you and live like you, because better them and their genetic material than others getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. Better the others get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. It doesn't work once you've made this compact to live together, either in a synagogue, or a city, or a state, or a nation, or in the case of climate change, the world itself. We are all part of certain biomes and biospheres that can't be broken. And we're all stuck in them together. We're all stuck on that ship together. So rage and digging a hole doesn't help anyone. So the sages talk about how God created. There's this sense the angels wanted God to create in one way, and that wouldn't be hospitable to human life. So they offer this parable. They say it's like a king who had some empty glasses, literally of glass. They have to be of glass for the story to work. So the king says, raise your hand if you've done this. If I pour hot water into them, they might burst. If it's cold, they'll snap. If I pour hot, then cold, they could snap. I mean, no one's done this but me. I've definitely done it. So what do you do? What did the ruler do? He mixed cold and hot water and poured it into them, and they withstood the cold and the hot. So the Holy Blessed One, that's the way that God creates the universe. You can't create based on mercy. That was one of the elements, the sort of the, you want to think about political spectra, left elements is the way that's understood in Judaism. Actually, that's understood as the right of God's elements. Because if you create by mercy, the sins and transgressions and injustices will be great. But were one to create on the basis of stern judgment, on strict law alone, the world couldn't exist. Human beings would fail. The systems would crack. So God says to God's self, I'm going to create it with this blend of mercy and judgment, and it will stand. The conservative movement has this terrible rap. This isn't a speech about join the conservative movement or protect it. But as Brad Artson would say, if there were no conservative movement, we'd have to start it again tomorrow, because it represents a fundamental element of Judaism and human life which is passionate moderation. That we don't just go for extreme strictness around the halakha, the Jewish tradition, nor do we just throw it out the window because it's inconvenient. And that mindset of holding both extremes at once through the difficulty and the mental exhaustion that causes is what conservative Judaism is here to teach and offer us. And what, frankly, I think it's authentically Jewish. It's a Jewish idea. Talmud says that Elazar ben Shimon said, you have to be pliable like a reed, not rigid like a cedar. My first chaplaincy teacher was a Buddhist priest, and she had also been a clown. I never saw the rest of the resume. I assume there was stuff in between. But she insisted we learn how to juggle. And you can buy those little juggling for the complete klutz, you know, harmonica playing for the musically incompetent, those little, do they still have them? It was a little book, and it came with webbing, and the juggling balls would be in the bag, or the harmonica would be in the bag, and it would teach you step by step, and you could get pretty far. As my mentor said, playing a triangle is harder than it looks, but not much. Harmonica's like that. It's harder than it looks, but not much. So she insisted that we learn to juggle because she said you have to be able to hold the left and the right in your peripheral vision at all times. You have to be able to hold paradox. You have to be able to hold things in tension. I think that's a really important message of Judaism. Being pliable like a reed, not rigid like a cedar, being able to hold the spectrum, the merism, the panoply of human experience, and not say it's neither nor, but it's both and. Another great spiritual practice is to eliminate the word but from your vocabulary. Every time you could say but, try to say the word and. I really love my job, but my boss is causing me a great headache. My kids are wonderful, but one of them is failing out of college. Don't say but, because that what it does linguistically is it eliminates the previous clause. Say and. They are both true. Your family, to quote one author, is the ones who cause the most grievous wounds and the ones who can salve them the most. It's all and. One thing doesn't negate the other. We have to hold it both. And that's, frankly, paradox. I was at Messiah Lutheran teaching about a year ago. I've told this story to some of you. This is the advantage of only coming for the high holidays. You don't have to hear my stories more than once. So I'm after I did a lunch teaching, and a guy walks up to me and he says, you know what I think about Jews? And I thought, oh my God, this is going to be so bad. But it was incredibly insightful. He said, it seems to me that Jews are really good with paradox. And I thought, yeah, that's the whole project. That's the Jewish project, is holding paradox. Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist who won the Nobel Prize in 1922, said that the opposite of a correct statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth may very well be another profound truth. The genesis of quantum thinking, that A and not A can both be true. I don't know if this is what Gene was doing, but Gene said, we should have worship in the chapel. And then when we'd have worship in the chapel, he'd say, I don't like worship in the chapel. I think they were both true. Maybe they were both true. I shouldn't have mentioned Gene because now I'm sad. That's it. I mean, that's the world we live in. It's non-Newtonian, and it's not simple whether you're on the left or the right, poor, rich, black, white, Christian, Jewish, Muslim. These all have to exist as profound truths within our heart and within our society and in our culture and embedded in who we are and our DNA. And this is where I think Judaism starts to get it really, really right. I don't believe that one religion or one faith or one worldview has a monopoly on truth. But this is, I think, a piece of what we bring to the world. So the sages teach, there's blessings for everything. You know, there's blessings when you see a rainbow. There's blessings when you eat your first peach of the season. There's blessings when fruit trees give fruit. There's blessings when you put up a mezuzah. So there's a blessing you say when you see, I think it's 600,000 Jews together. I think the last time this happened was at Rav Ovadia Yosef's funeral. He was one of the Gedolei Hador, the greatest of the generation, died maybe 2 years ago now. And some significant percentage of the Israeli population came for his funeral. Like 500,000 easily came out for his funeral. So back in the Talmud, they debate what you're supposed to say when you see this giant populace of Jews. And you say, according to the unnamed sages, blessed is the wise one who knows secrets. Because this one's thought process is not like this one's thoughts, and their faces don't look alike. And then Ben Zoma offers a further idea. He was at the Temple Mount, presumably, well, it wouldn't have been during a sacrifice season because the temple had already been destroyed, but let's say he saw a lot of people. I guess they were there for a party. And he says the same thing. He said, blessed is the wise one who knows secrets, and blessed is the one who created each of these to serve me. I think if you put those two together, that each of your thoughts is different to the person next to you, your face is different to the person next to you, and God made all of those things for God's service. That you were created uniquely and distinctly to have some calling and some role to play in the world, and that role can't be denied. And so your neighbor who voted for the other city council candidate, your friend who likes early Beatles and you like late Beatles is probably correct also. It's debatable. But we all exist for a value. We all have value before God's eyes, and it is in some ways precisely because of our difference that God treasures us. So here's what I want us all to work on this year. Reinvigorating civil debate. Not just civic, but civil. I think there's this great opportunity here in Upper East Tennessee, especially in the city of Knoxville and its environs, because fundamentally we're a pragmatic polity. We're not a dogmatic polity. We are one that wants things to work. That Republican mayors like Victor Ash have instituted programs to create greenways. That Democratic mayors have instituted programs to streamline budgets. That we are not diehards in our beliefs. That we are not fixed in our judgments. That we, as Mayor Herr would say, good people can disagree. And so in addition to saying and rather than but, I want you to try a few others. Don't talk about enemies. Bob Dole, when he ran against Clinton in 96, was asked some question, you know, what do you think about your enemy's opinion? And he immediately corrected him. He said, Bill Clinton is not my enemy, he's my opponent. And here's the one I'm working on. Karen pointed this out to me. I couldn't believe this is what I say. Don't say people are wrong. Say that you disagree with them. I didn't say it would be easy. So I'm not suggesting that we just let everything slide, but I think it is through open debate and listening and the ability to put the drunk's head in our lap and care for him, though he may be so radically different to who we are, that will allow this ship of state to cohere and patch its leaks. I'm not saying that we forgive and forget and that everything is tolerable and that the Overton window, which is to say the space in which we allow public discourse to occur, should just keep expanding ad infinitum. I'm saying what Frederick Douglass said, which is that the one who is a lover of one's country is the one who rebukes and does not excuse its sins. And I'm saying what Mark Twain said, which is loyalty to country always, loyalty to government as it deserves it. You don't form civic discourse or even civil discourse by just allowing anything. But you have honest debates, not just ones where you shout at each other. So when I first started thinking about this a year ago, a friend of mine says, just like a Rebbetzin, Karen says, what does the Talmud have to say about this? She didn't say it like that. And this is what I've said to school groups and church groups and classrooms here and individuals here. And they pick up on it, and it's so rich for all of the communities of Upper East Tennessee, the idea that Judaism is a religion of paradox and questions. When we worry about Jews leaving the Jewish community, I can tell you that there are at least as many people coming into the Jewish community because it's a place that's safe to ask questions. And the Me'el Shiloach, who is Yosef Lehner of Ishbitza, writing in the 19th century, points out that Torah is a book of questions, not answers. And in polite disagreement, he is not wrong, is another profound truth about the Talmud. Brad Artson says the meta commentary of the Talmud is that things get better or things get worse. They can't stay the same. I believe that a meta commentary of the Talmud is how do we disagree with each other? It's a question about arguments across generations, across geographic and demographic domains. It's a question that preserves every question. It's a document that anthologizes and preserves every question, no matter how arcane or irrelevant at the time, because we might need that question later. It's a document, it's a book, it's a collection, it's a richness for us that says to us, the inheritance of Judaism is asking good questions. And the inheritance of Judaism is living in paradox. And the inheritance of conservative Judaism and all Judaisms is being free to listen and to struggle and not to decide, to delay judgment. So I'll close with one of the best stories about this. And I hope in the coming months and years to promote with you the Jewish values of paradox and questioning to our community, and maybe that'll spread even further to the larger body politic. So Reish Lakish was this brigand, according to Miriam, a gladiator, a road marauder maybe. And Rabbi Yochanan was this very, very pretty sage. There is a little homoerotic subtext in the initial document. I'm not going to go into that. So they have this big fight, and this is just preamble, and Rabbi Yochanan says something nasty to Reish Lakish that reminds him of his past. You know, you're not supposed to remind people of the times before they repented. It's like when you have a fight with your spouse and you remind them of something they did 10 years ago, and they've been trying for 10 years to get over it and be better, a better spouse. Everyone's looking at me like they know exactly what I'm talking about. Don't pull out the notebook of things your spouse did 10 years ago. Right? So he says that, and Reish Lakish dies. And Rabbi Yochanan is exquisitely grieving. He's just heartbroken because Reish Lakish had been a study partner for some long amount of time at that point. And so the sages set him up with someone new. And they're like, oh, we should get him someone new, you know, because when your spouse dies, you should start dating again. That's that kind of mindset, right? Like you can fill in the void by filling the gap. So they find Rabbi Elazar ben Padat, who's very smart. And he's very subtle, very learned. And he goes and he visits Rabbi Yochanan and they study together. And every time Rabbi Yochanan says, he says, you're making a good point. I have another thing that adds to your point. Let me tell you something else that shows that you're right. This goes on a little while, and Rabbi Yochanan says, oh my God, I hate this so much. Where's Reish Lakish? You are terrible. Well, You know, Reish Lakish, I would state a law, and he used to raise 24 objections, and then I had to give 24 different answers, which led to a fuller comprehension of what we were studying. Whereas you are a sycophant. You just tell me I'm right. What good does that do me? And he moaned and he moaned about the loss of that study partnership, that dynamic, paradoxical, deep questioning of each other until he died. You probably know this already, even before I started this talk. And for many of you, whatever you dislike about our faith, probably somewhere deep in your bones is the awareness that it is a safe place to ask questions and to debate. And at the end of the day, after you've debated with someone, you love each other nonetheless. We got to model that. We got to model that here, Knoxville, Knox County, Upper East Tennessee, Tennessee, America, and beyond. That's our destiny. And that's your calling.